Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have one of our authors, another one with us, Charlotte Allen. We're here at Catholic University where Charlotte earned her PhD in medieval studies in about 10 years ago?
Yeah, actually a little less, 2011.
2011, oh, yes. Okay. She's written for us several times. She's a prominent journalist. She writes in the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and many, many other places, often on religious topics. And today we have a topic related to an article that you have for us coming out on this guy who, about 1,000 years ago?
It was about 1,000 years ago, the mid 11th century. When he was born. And the thing about Peter Damian is that you see his name everywhere in passing, but you know very little about him. Learning about him, doing research on him, I mean, it unveiled what was a complete mystery. Of course, the 11th century was pretty much a mystery, too, to me. One of the few things I knew about it was the Norman conquest and, of course, the great schism between the East and West in 1050. But Peter Damian lived through all of those things. He was born, I think, around 1042 to a family in Ravenna. He was Italian, and one of the interesting things about learning about him was how many Italians there were involved in the great Gregorian church reforms of that century. For example, Gregory the Seventh, Hildebrand, was also an Italian, a Tuscan, and he and Peter Damian were friends. But at any rate, I should probably go back and kind of cover Damian's biography.
Sure. Well, so probably Pietro Damiano.
Yeah, that was probably what he was known as to his family. Yeah, he was in fact Pietro, and then he took his older brother Damiano, Damian's name, because he was born into a poor but noble family somewhere near in the Marche district, sort of near the Tuscan border, kind of north, I guess north central Italy, you might say. And so, at any rate, when his parents died, there was no money, except an elder brother who seemed to have some sort of farm or estate. So he put Peter to work as a swineherd, basically, this young boy, giving him no education. And Peter was exhausted, working around the farm.
Why give him education when there's work to do?
That's right. And he was a younger son, and younger sons never counted at all. You were on your own. At any rate, during his teenage years, he was rescued by another of his older brothers named Damian, and took Damian's name, so he became Peter Damian. And his older brother realized that he was a very intelligent young man and immediately got a great education for him, university education, and he became himself a university professor in Ravenna and some other city besides Ravenna and Parma. Parma was the other city.
So there were universities.
There were,
yes. Were they monasteries?
That's right. They were probably. I mean, universities grew out of the cathedral schools in the cities. The cities educating their own priests to be canons, that is, priests attached to the cathedral itself. And so that's probably where Damian picked up his education. He was undoubtedly educated for the priesthood himself, and so he then became a lecturer, a very well-known lecturer and a writer. And then at the age of about 30, he decided to give all of that up, and he went to Fonte Avellano, a monastery that became associated with the Carthusians, basically a monastery of hermits.
He walked away from tenure?
He walked
Charlotte?
Away from tenure.
How I didn't think
be?
This happens.
Right? He probably had a lot of prestige, not a lot of money, but a lot of prestige as a university lecturer. But at any rate, he did it. And so he went off to this mountainous hermitage, basically. Hermits living in communion. They all had their little huts and cells, but they lived in communion with each other, and that became the life. And he wrote a rule, in fact, for his friend Saint Romuald, who founded the Carthusians. This was a time when new religious orders were being founded, sort of takeoffs from the usual Benedictine template. And so, Peter Damian lived there basically for the rest of his life. He became the abbot in 1042 and died in 1072. So he was abbot there for 36 years, although he was picked by one of the reforming popes to be a cardinal. He was unwillingly. He didn't really want that sort of...
So wait, when was he born, roughly?
He was born roughly, I think, around the 20s.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. I can't quite remember the year offhand. So he became a cardinal and, of course, got a counselor to popes. There was a whole series of reforming popes during the... We think of Gregory VII as the great reformer, but in fact, the reform began earlier and ended later. It essentially took up the whole second half of the 11th century. And, of course...
And he was a part of this.
And he was a part of it. He was a key part of it. The issues... He was a great friend of Hildebrand, who became pope, Gregory, around the year that Peter died, that Peter Damian died. But they were friends in their youth. And of course, they had the same issues. The great issues then were simony, that is, buying and selling holy offices, lay investiture, which was the interference by various lay authorities, particularly the Holy Roman Emperor, who had a constant claim to Italian cities, as we know from Dante, that there was the battles between who was going to be running Italy between the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. So the Holy Roman Emperor then essentially tried to and usually succeeded in picking popes and bishops and so forth. So there were those two, simony, lay investiture, and the third one was sexual morality among the clergy, which seemed to be pretty abysmal, even though the Western Church had embraced a rule of celibate clergy from the 4th century, the 5th century. It was basically not observed at all.
Well, I've heard some of my liberal friends saying that the whole celibacy rule actually began only in the 12th century.
Oh, yeah.
But
that
didn't exist before.
Right. No,
that's not true.
But it did exist. It existed,
but
it
was just ignored.
Honored in the breach. Yeah. I mean, priests, especially the farther north you got in Europe, the more you saw married clergy. Openly married clergy. Yeah. In England, for example, the father of Aelred of Rivaux, the great 12th century Cistercian, was a married priest who was finally persuaded. What happened there was that with the Norman conquest, basically William the Conqueror brought Gregorian reform to England. So all the married priests, who basically kind of owned their churches, they were part of their inheritance, both from their fathers, who were often priests, to one of their sons, who would be a priest. And so William and his bishops basically altered the whole system insistently, and they relieved all of these priests, including Aelred's father, of their parish churches. And Aelred's father then went and lived in a monastery. He had a whole bunch of children. He was legitimately married. But that was the situation. Married priests and also concubines. Popes had mistresses. There were several notorious 10th century popes who had successive lovers of one particular Roman woman, Marozia. I mean, she started out as mistress to a pope when she was 15, and so she had lots of time to move on to other popes, and she had at least three papal lovers, at least according to the chronicles. Of course, the chronicles always enjoyed a good scandal. But there's no reason not to believe them. They're the evidence we've got.
Right.
But you can see what a mess the whole situation was, and especially with buying and selling offices.
And Peter comes in.
So Peter comes in, and of course he's one of a number of people who are quite scandalized by this. And of course there was, at least according to Peter, there was a big problem with homosexuality among the clergy too, which he pointed out. He was also a friend of Pope Leo the Ninth, who came in 1049. He was made pope in 1049. His predecessor had been one of the most terrible popes, or his sort of predecessor, who had been one of the most terrible popes of the 11th century. And that was Benedict the Ninth, who was Pope three times. He's starting at age 20 when he was not even in holy orders. He was a layman.
How does a layman with no holy training, orders, experience become pope?
I guess you just, well, you get it because you belong to a wealthy Roman family, which he did. His family, they were the Counts of Tusculum, which is like in a suburb of Rome. And so, and of course, that was one of the problems with the papacy, was that it was kind of traded around among wealthy Roman families. And so so he got in and got elected. I don't know how. I don't know how. I don't know what papal elections really were then, but they obviously existed. The cardinals, as you know, were all from wealthy Roman families themselves till and through the Renaissance. So that had a lot to do with it. At any rate, he got in, and then he was thrown out, basically, in around 1040, 1045, 1046, because of various things, mostly dealing with his sex life, which was quite scandalous, and he was believed to be homosexual, although also possibly bisexual, since adultery was one of the crimes he was accused of committing, and bribery, suborning bribery, you name it. So he was thrown out, and then another pope came in. But then that pope died, and yet another pope was elected. And meanwhile, Benedict was still claiming to be pope. So that pope was overthrown. So there were actually three people claiming to be pope. Benedict and the two others. So at this point, Henry III came in and swept out all three, basically, and installed his own pope. But that pope didn't live very long.
Okay.
So Benedict managed to stage a comeback and, I guess, got reelected pope. But then he decided to sell his throne to his godfather, who became the next pope. And so he went off. Pope Benedict decided to stage another comeback. So he came back, apparently bribed his way to the papal throne again, and this time Henry summarily threw him out and got another pope in who was the predecessor for Pope Leo IX, who was really the first good pope. He was one of a series of, he was canonized, a series of saintly reforming popes.
So we thank Benedict.
Yeah, we thank Benedict.
He was so bad, he did good.
That he did good, that there was there was obviously a scandal situation. And I'm sure that, as with all homosexual, what can you call it? I wouldn't call it a ring, but there was obviously a lot of...
A network.
I think that's a good way to characterize it, network.
Yeah.
There were obviously networks, and it's something that not too long after Pope Leo was installed, which was in 1049, Peter Damian decided to write all this up in a very long letter to him.
So, bringing in a new good pope wasn't going to cleanse all of the conditions that led to this pope.
It was through the system. Yeah, it was through the system, and it took Leo and his successors forever. Leo immediately called a synod to try to tackle some of these problems, especially the simony and the sexuality issue. Yeah, and the married priest issue, which was even more, because of course there are many more heterosexual priests in these dubious relationships.
But Peter Damian writes this long letter.
So he writes this long letter, and it's basically about what to do about homosexual activity in the clergy. And it's a very graphic letter because the elements had been well defined in canon law, and Peter was a canon law expert. And so he writes about these various stages of sodomy, as he called them. That was what the offense was called, and it could include everything from masturbation to caressing another person of the same sex to finally anal intercourse, the most serious. offense of all. And basically what had happened, the standards were at the time that unless you were found, you were found to have committed anal intercourse, you could basically stay on. You could do whatever you wanted to. You did get thrown out if you did that of holy orders, or you couldn't be admitted. But these other offenses, basically, you could just do some penance, and then you could go right back to where you were.
Even if it was same sex.
Yeah. And what Peter Damian was saying was that these priests would go to another homosexual priest as their confessor and get a real pass. They'd get a light penance, and then it was back to whatever they were doing, back to the party, you might say. Mm-hmm. And this seemed to be going on with bishops as well. Bishops were condoning this. I mean, that is where we have a situation. We had a situation that was very much like what seems to be going on in the Catholic Church today. I mean, it seems obvious to me, to digress a little bit, that there were networks. People were known to be homosexual offenders, and they got right back where they did. So what Damian did in his lengthy letter was to describe this lax state of affairs and to essentially say that this was just a scandal, that men should be offering the Eucharist who had committed these carnal sins. And one of the things that we have to understand in the context of that time is that people really did regard these acts as unnatural, that they were, and he said in his letter, you know, this is like the bull desiring, you know, trying to climb on top of another bull or a donkey.
And he worked in the fields as a child. He never saw these things,
right, or the sheep. I mean, he had a whole catalog of animals. He never saw anything like this. And this is how people really regarded those acts. It's only in extremely recent years that society has developed this other attitude that these are somehow natural if they make you happy. They're different. You know,
that's
they're
all.
Something we might not want to engage in, but they're just different. But during the Middle Ages and up until quite recently, sex was associated with procreation. And if an act was not procreative, it was just not, it was sinful. It was not natural. It was not the right thing to do.
And in Damian's letter, it doesn't say about whether you are or not homosexual, whether you do have same-sex attraction. It's just about the acts.
It's about the acts.
It's what you do.
Yeah, exactly. And so there was no problem, I suppose, if you had homosexual inclinations, which I'm sure that some did. And some say that Aelred of Rivaux did, because he wrote very passionately about friendships, spiritual friendships that could transpire between monks. And so perhaps for him there was a same-sex attraction, but he certainly never acted on it that we know of. And that was basically the thing. It was what you did. There was no, if you look at the canon law manual that Peter Damian relied on to define these acts, you see no difference. You see whole catalogs of sins, incest and adultery and other things, bestiality, doing it with animals. They had a clear sense of a lot of different acts that were unnatural, and they were down on all of them and would mete out penances for all of them, for lay people. But for priests, I mean, they really put the clergy, priests and monks, were in a different category. And for them, in Damian's view, it wasn't just a matter of doing a penance, doing a severe penance. He wanted to see those people out of the priesthood and just ejected from the priesthood, degraded, it was called. And he attached that very properly. He said, this is, you know, almost drawing a distinction. He did not draw a distinction between lay people and the priesthood. His letter concerned only transgressions of the priesthood. Mm-hmm. But he was adamant that these people did not belong in the church, transforming the sacraments or transforming the bread and wine into Christ's body, handling Christ's body. Mm-hmm. And that this was an affront. And so he wrote the letter, and it's quite passionate, to Leo. Leo wrote a response that is preserved in the manuscripts of the letter, and essentially agreed with Peter Damian, except he did think that if you committed some of these lesser offenses, masturbation and so forth, and mutual masturbation, that you could, and you didn't do it maybe a couple of times, you yielded to temptation a couple of times, maybe with a couple of people. But if you left it at that, he said, after a suitable penance, you could get back in. But basically, he agreed with everything that Peter Damian had said, and that it was now time to really crack down.
You know, Charlotte, what you said about these people are then asked to administer the Eucharist. When you think about someone like McCarrick and coming up to him and taking the host and you know the body of Christ, something doesn't fit.
It doesn't.
You can't do this. Can't be the one. This is a sacrament, and you're not the person. It hits you.
Yeah.
In a visceral way.
Yeah. Now I suppose you could say, which is what Cardinal Wuerl and others are saying, that no one really knew, but then no one bothered to investigate. And that seems to be really where the problem was.
But I thought the rumors were pretty.
Were widespread, and it wasn't a matter. It clearly fell into Pope Leo's category of numerous offenses.
Yeah.
Over a long period of time.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, tied in some sense with Simony. We see Simony as just paying for an office, but there's something about the perks of higher office in the church that can be regarded as a kind of simony, as a kind of buying your way into this rather comfortable, if not luxurious, life that McCarrick seemed to be leading, flying around
first class,
the world first class. That's right.
Not bad.
Right. He had a beach house. We don't have a beach house.
I don't have a beach house.
Yeah.
I wish I did.
I know, it would be nice, wouldn't it?
Well, now Charlotte, why didn't the Pope receive this letter and say, "Oh, okay, this is good. I think over," and then toss it in the trash can?
He took it seriously. People took that seriously, and it's what seems to be so different from our age, where it just to this day, it's not being taken seriously, except when minors are involved, and then it's taken seriously. That's a crime,
right?
But it's not taken. You hear about it. I don't know how much of these rumors are true about entire seminaries as being operated as little gay clubs.
Right.
I have no idea whether I tended to discount that. In fact, I always thought, well, these are ultra conservative Catholics who are looking for a sin under every bed or in every bed.
Right.
But now, with these revelations about McCarrick and about this widespread stuff in Pittsburgh, I don't really know. I want to think the best, but I don't really, and it really gives me the creeps.
Well, with Damien's letter, was it published and circulated?
Oh, it was circulated widely. It was copied and copied. There are hundreds
of manuscripts. So he struck a chord that a lot of people were ready to hear.
Yeah, dozens of manuscripts. There are, and it acquired a name, the Liber Gomorianus. After Gomorrah, it actually had it. So it had a life of its own. And Leo's letter, the two were usually copied down together. And then finally, it made it into print during the early 17th century. So it was edited by some priest.
Did it become sort of part of canon law, part of the rules and regulations?
Well, it didn't become. Well, it did become part of canon law because the penances were there. So it was obviously taken very seriously. I don't know, because we don't know how widespread the problem was back then.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that much about priests who were actually disciplined for this.
You do hear some, you mentioned one historian, scholars who say that the homosexuality issue wasn't really considered a problem until the 19th century, when homosexuality was pathologized. That before this, it was a much freer, sort of accepted practice, and that Damian's letter is just kind of an anomaly.
An eccentricity. Yeah. But it couldn't have been, because it was obviously taken seriously enough to be copied. Enough, you know, I think right. There are a couple dozen manuscripts, and that's a lot for a letter, a papal document.
Right.
That would have been of interest, presumably, only to canon lawyers.
And do we have evidence that it had an impact, that there was a purification to some efforts toward that in the church?
There was, in fact, a purification in that the mores of churchmen did seem to significantly change. I mean, it took forever to wipe out priestly concubines. In fact, they were still around at the Reformation, especially in Northern Europe, in remote parishes, remote rural parishes, where there wasn't a lot of supervision from the bishop. And so the priest would get lonely and take a lady into his house, his housekeeper, his sister, he would call her. Sometimes he would call her his sister. There's a wonderful book about some of the counter-reformation efforts to clean up diocese in Belgium. And it seemed to be the practice. These were parishes where the priest was basically living hand-to-mouth on his farm. It took a long time to root this stuff out. But in fact, there was a great spiritual reform at the end of the 11th century and throughout the 12th, where you saw new religious orders, the Cistercians, the Carthusians, the Gilbertines, very popular that young people flocked to, young men and women. And those didn't seem to have the problem. Sometimes there were a couple of those orders. The Gilbertines had men and women living in monasteries side by side. And there was always a belief that there was scandal, but we don't really know a whole lot about it. I mean, there were scandals, nuns getting pregnant and so forth, but at any rate, there was a real moral reform, and it seemed to make a huge difference.
Are people going back to Damian's letter today?
Well,
as a reflection upon sort of we've seen this before.
No, well, sadly not. I mean, he's been covered, you might say, but in a rather negative way.
Repressive.
Yes, repressive. Intolerance, a kind of crank. You probably know John Boswell's Homosexuality and Sexual Tolerance from the early Christianity through the Middle Ages. And of course, he writes about most of the Middle Ages as being rather this rosy period where, even though on the books homosexuality was a sin, there was a kind of gay culture and it was tolerated. And Golden Age of Gays, the 12th century, for example. And it's kind of unrecognizable. He's got Aelred in there as a prime example. He's got Abelard.
He has Abelard in there, not Eloise.
Not Eloise, that's right. Yeah, because Abelard wrote a kind of love song or love poem or poem of affection about David and Jonathan. And so of course, that's the only work of Abelard's that appears in the book. You'd think he'd written nothing else, no theology, no other poetry, no love letters to Heloise, nothing.
Right.
But that was the attitude. His thesis, he, very influential book, published in 1980. His thesis was that Christians tended to condemn or approve of homosexuality according to the mores of secular society. So during Roman days, no problem with it, except for a few oddballs like John Chrysostom, who was quite adamant on the subject. Then the Dark Ages, maybe a little bit but that those were secular attitudes. Then comes along the High Middle Ages, and everything is great until the 13th century, when you suddenly get the Inquisition, Thomas Aquinas, robustly condemning homosexual activity, and you get laws mandating the death penalty for homosexual acts. And so he sees kind of the curtain falling then, and then various, I guess, stages after that that he doesn't go into much until the 19th century, when you do have these crimes against nature. Mm-hmm. You have people like Oscar Wilde being persecuted. Anyway, it's a very rosy view, and of course it's been accepted by all secular intellectuals and liberal Christians, because we now have gay bishops in the Episcopal Church and mm-hmm. gay marriage rights in various other mainline Protestant denominations.
We had a reform come out. This will be my last question. We had a reform come out in the wake of Peter Damian. Are we going to get a reform to come out in the wake of the Vigano?
Well, I mean, we should. But the problem is, of course, we live in a very different age where people do not see. I mean, people have been told for 40 years that homosexual inclinations are perfectly natural. They're just a kind of variant, and like other variants, other sexual desires or inclinations. So, like, you know, we see this transgender. I mean, that would have been quite made quite the stir back in the Middle Ages. But now it's just accepted. And people have to be called by their whatever pronoun they choose. And I mean, we just live in an age, and it's infected. It's really infected everybody, and it's very difficult, if you do believe these traditional things, to make a case for them without seeming to be anti-gay and hurt their feelings.
It's not just that you're old-fashioned, you're out of the mainstream, you're not up to date.
Yeah.
You're evil, and we're going to come after you.
Oh, yeah. Well, look at the situation with gay marriage, for example, which up until 10 years ago, it was mainstream. I mean, even liberals, Hillary Clinton, Obama. They said, well, it's fine. Civil unions are fine, but we're not going to, you know, gay marriage is between a man and a woman. Then suddenly the zeitgeist completely changes. You have people driven from their jobs, like the head of Google.
The head of Mozilla.
Mozilla. Firefox. He's driven from his job. I mean, and now you cannot say
We're going to boycott. We're going to shame and everything else.
Getting in trouble. If you can't not bake a cake for a gay wedding, I mean, that's where our society is. So you have tremendous social pressure from secular society, and it's very difficult to persuade ordinary Catholics who are poorly catechized to begin with, the collapse of Catholic education. They know little about the faith and the traditional faith. Mm-hmm. And how do you persuade those people? So where does the moral reform come from? Well, I think and we also have the other problem that we've seen the kind of the destruction after Vatican II of so much of traditional Catholicism, in other areas, the liturgy, the saints, statuary and churches, all of these things, the rosary, traditional prayers, that provided a kind of a source of faith and beauty that stood independently of the secular culture. Mm-hmm. So we've seen the destruction of all of that, so it's very difficult to rebuild that. And I mean, you're seeing some of that with young Catholics, who are much more traditional than revere the tradition, the liturgy. But it's going to take a long time. Those are very small groups. They're little tiny core groups. I mean, even here at Catholic U, at least when I was in graduate school, I mean, it was clear that most of the undergraduates whom I taught in classes knew nothing about their faith, and they were baptized Catholics growing up in presumably in culturally Catholic households, lots of Irish and Italians, and they knew nothing about their faith. So, and this is here at a Catholic university. It might have changed. I mean, it's been a while since I was in grad school, but wholesale indifference. So, I think it can change, and I hope it will. I mean, our only hope for the future is in our Catholic young people who seem to be determined to raise Catholic families. But there's so much. I mean, even something like birth control. If the, you know, back what, 1968, Pope Paul comes out and reiterates the Church's position. But no one pays any attention to it. No bishops. They try to kind of skate by it. We've got to keep our members. So we're going to kind of skate by it. Yeah, it's on the books, but there's no, you know, it's never really explained, never taught, never taken the slightest bit seriously. And of course, I think the same thing has happened with the whole question of homosexual acts, that you have seminaries where apparently, because maybe pre-shortage or whatever, there's just not a lot of screening. And I'm not saying I don't think that homosexuals per se should be kept out of the priesthood, that because you have same-sex attraction, but I think that you got to monitor people very carefully for acting out. I think once you start that, well,
look at the conditions you're putting them into.
Yeah, yeah, right, of right all, there. All men and yeah. a lot of access intense. To young people.
Yeah.
Who are being mentored by you, or when you're doing your pastoral training. I mean, it's.
Well, I think that I've got to believe more and more young people just look around. Is this the world you want to live in?
Yeah.
Turn on the TV. Go on to the internet. Walk down the street in major cities and say to yourself, would this be better if people were more observant of Catholic doctrine?
Yeah. It is.
Who would say no?
Yeah, it's right now it's an insane situation, because you have people growing up in homes with no fathers, and that seems to be spreading all across the board.
Family breakdown is everywhere.
Yeah, well, look, it's everywhere. And once, even in middle class, where there's homes where there's a divorce, what sort of cynicism do young people who grow up in a household like that have?
Yeah. Yeah.
Toward marriage, for example,
maybe for them, the more and more they'll see the church as a way out.
Yeah, of if that the church kind of can set that example,
if the church will set that example, that's right.
But you just you're just not hearing a lot of that example being set.
Well, let's see, Charlotte, in the next couple of years, if we don't see some Peter Damian letters.
Well, it would
coming
be
out
if
at
we,
the
yeah.
At the lower levels.
Oh, it would it would really be great if we did, if people who just
had
can't
enough.
Take the situation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Right now, I mean, somebody like Vigano is regarded as the crank Peter Damian of our time, mm-hmm. at least by the John Boswell faction, which is the huge liberal Catholic faction. And of course, Pope Francis has just done nothing. And
right. But I don't think that's working.
Yeah.
Charlotte, I don't think...
I don't think it is either. I mean, I think a lot of conservative Catholics... I mean, I've always thought, well, Pope Francis is not my favorite pope, but he is the pope, and he seems to be devoted to the rosary and so forth, and believes in the devil, so he couldn't be all bad. Right. But now, you know, I mean, this whole situation is shocking. That
it
he
has
will
to be
not
addressed.
Speak. He will not speak.
It has to be addressed.
And it has to be addressed. But he won't say anything. I don't know. It's so strange. The situation is so odd.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, look, Charlotte, I want to have you back again. We've done this before.
Yes,
and we will, readers, look forward to the next issue of First Things. You'll see Charlotte's name in it, and I want to thank you.
Okay. Well, okay. I'm happy to talk to you, Mark, anytime.
Thank you.